saying how much they want a strong woman. What they really want is a cheerleader.
I'd like someone who's physically very frail and won't stop talking.
I just want what everybody wants. I just seem to have a harder time getting it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 321. And you know how it gets done. It's your host, Ify Whitey, weighing in the booth with me, all my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have the Christmas Daddy. Just the door that says, do not open till Christmas season is creeped. We see the smoke coming out. You just seeping from the edges, just as you hear Alonzo's slow breathing. It's the Christmas Daddy and my favorite critic, Alonzo Duralde. What's good?
A Spielbergian ray of light emerges from beneath. I'll tell you, you know, if you, we always, I believe I have in this particular section of the show before praised the Herr's Snack Company, Herr's, for their like Old Bay cheese puffs, which continue off the chain. But in a world where we always talk about how, you know, we don't have regionalisms anymore and everything is being flattened out by mega corporations and the internet and, you know, one cookie cutter mall after another is all America is anymore. Hers is still keeping it local in a way that I now have to rely upon people to like send me stuff because we're not going to get it here in Los Angeles. So they did an entire flavored by Philly line of chips. Where they, and I think they're taking votes from people to pick the winner, but they've got three flavors of potato chips that are inspired by local Philadelphia like beloved restaurants. So you've got your roast pork sandwich chips, your Korean barbecue wings chips, and your tomato pie chips. And they are all a slice of heaven. And I've never even actually eaten the real Philly food that these are based on. But just going by the chips, I'm already a fan of all of this stuff.
And these are available in like your average grocery store? Do you have to order them online? What's the...
No, you pretty much have to live in the Northeast, I think, to get your hands on it. I was... My dear friend Martin handed them off to me at the Deck the Hallmark event I was recently at. And so, like, yeah, find yourself a procurer in the greater Philadelphia area to send you these chips because you'll be glad you did.
A chip dealer.
Yes.
Yeah. Everybody needs one. Philly chip dealer.
You know.
You need a Philly chip guy. Yeah. Well, and I got a Minnesota pontoon girl, and I'm going to introduce you to her right now. It's Super Festival programmer and producer Drea Clark. What's good?
What's good with me? Related to today's programming that we're discussing, I just found out about this. It's apparently been around for like 5 or 6 years, but as you guys know, it tied in with my love of skincare. I am a girl who is deeply committed to hydration. I drink at least 160 ounces of water a day. Love it. Love being hydrated. Also, I pee all the time. Does that give me a little form of anxiety going to a 3.5 hour movie? It does, because I respect cinema. I do not like to leave the theater. And yet, I know how my body works. Did you guys know that there is an app called Run Pee? In fact, if you have the AMC app, this is how I did it. When you go to, I clicked on the Killers of the Flower Moon, and then you click on details and you scroll down and it gives you a number of suggestions of what's a good time to pee. And so it says like at 67 minutes, and it gives you a sort of dialogue prompt to look for. And it was something about like Leonardo DiCaprio was going to say something about my wife, my lovely wife. And then I knew at that point I could scurry to the bathroom. And then there's a drop down and it will tell you what happens in the like minute after. And it was like in the next minute, like just as a quick overview. So you're not like super kerfuddled and lost. Do I recommend this as a way to catch the entirety of a movie? No, but what a great idea. Now I'm only finding about it now. And the fact that it's in the official AMC app as well. Makes me laugh forever. So, yeah. Run pee.
It's such a banger idea because, you know,
it is like, it's like you never want to miss a second, but if you had to, it's great to get like, all right, look, I'll be able to fill you in on this. Is it a, is it a montage? Is it like, you know, like here's
and it
here's,
worked. It worked.
Oh, excellent. Yes. I have to say, like, I you know, you get a pass because of your 160 ounces of water a day habit, but the when people who didn't blink at the thought of a 168-minute Taylor Swift movie or a three-hour-plus Avengers movie are squawking about the length of this movie, it's like,
oh, yeah.
No.
No, I have zero complaints about the length of things when I think it's, like, done well and certain that we'll get into it this movie.
Sure.
Yeah. It's every minute. Yeah. It's oh no, I know how things work and I don't like to miss things. But yeah, I'm with you, Alonzo. Like, come on, you all watch 8 hours straight of TV. Let's not kid ourselves.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was able to last the whole movie, and I went in post like having like a smoothie from the gym and a whole cherry lemonade and a large that you know how AMC is pushing that weird Fanta where it's really just a mix of all the drinks, a whole large thing of that.
Oh my. See, you said that like a brag, and really that makes me concerned for your system.
Oh, that, my water intake? Don't worry.
Not that you're not taking enough. I'm like, huh, you're really holding on to those liquids for a good while.
He's got, if he has a bladder like his thighs.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, of course. Okay,
mighty.
Okay.
Also, I do a lot of edging. No need to look that up there.
I know that. No, you're going to be connected to it forever. That's all right. Dang it. What's good with you?
Yeah, not that I really want to know now, but yeah, what is good?
Besides the edging.
Yeah, right? I was like, I don't know if there's anything left for you to share. Oh,
The reason I was so like kind of covert with like the cherry lemonade and where it was from was because it is in fact my what's good. A friend of mine took me to the spot in Pasadena called Perry's Joint, which I don't know if any of you had it. It's a sandwich shop, but connects with Alonzo because the creator, Perry, is from Philadelphia, even though there are no Perry's Joints in Philadelphia. And they were from Philadelphia, and they're like, I want him to open this in Philly so I can have it. And I gotta say, I had the chef's special, which was like, it was like a turkey meat with the chicken salad came together and I had it on a dark sweet wheat bread, and it seems like it shouldn't go together, but it really does. It really
stop selling.
Yeah, so highly it's well priced, not too far away. Great sandwich shop. If you're looking for a good sandwich, which is always wild because I feel like sandwiches are those things that you don't like, you don't seek them out, but when you have a good sandwich, you're like, oh, that's a good sandwich.
That place also sounds like it should be where you could find your Philly chip guy. Like,
oh,
I
know.
They really should look at a collab.
They should funnel it cross country. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah, that's what's good with me, especially since Ziv, which was in Highland Park, closed, which was a banger sandwich shop that was so close to me. And I was like, damn, I miss having a good sandwich shop. But this isn't a sandwich podcast. This is a movie podcast. So we're going to
do a sandwich podcast. Just putting that out into the world, you know.
But yeah, in today's show, we're going to be digging into Killers of the Flower Moon. Then we'll talk about director actor partnerships. But first, it's time for Itadick, our movie news segment where we answer the question, is this important and do we care, by going through the week's movie news. So first up, the SAG-AFTRA strike hits 100 days, and talks resume this week. This past Saturday, October 21st, marked the 100th day of the SAG-AFTRA strike, and that milestone came with some good news. The studios have apparently recovered from the tantrum that ended the last round of negotiations and have asked the union to return to the negotiation table. Talks will resume on Tuesday the 24th, which is tomorrow for us, but will be in the past for you listeners. But is this important? Do you care?
I mean, this all sucks. Good for SAG. Hold strong. You should. You deserve everything you're asking for. Watching them drag this out, like, it felt for a moment after WGA, you know, figured its shit out. Not the WGA. Once that situation was figured out, like, oh, surely, surely we all see the light now. Come, let's come to the porch, however lights work. And so having, watching SAG still dealing with this, and on top of that, all of the crews who are suffering as a result, because this, you know, if you are in this world, you also know, like, this town is a stupid Deadsville from December on. Like, people decide breaking for the holidays begins like December 1st. And so it's not just a, oh, we're all waiting for this. It's the idea of when all of that then means it falls in line for people getting back to work. So huge, heart out to it. But I do know that on the, you know, after the 100th day, when they came back to the table this week, that SAG put out the call for a big showing at the picket lines, and they did. People came out in force. I hope they continue to. The unions have continued to come out and support them. It's wonderful and terrible to see. How's that? Wonderful and terrible?
It works for me. The interesting takeaway for me in all this is, you know, I thought for sure that we'd have gotten resolution by now, if only because it's award season, and they do so desperately need these performers on the red carpet and giving interviews and going to festivals and talking up these movies, and that's not happening. And so you're seeing like some version of that going out, but with no actors involved, and it kind of puts into perspective. We talk about like how much, you know, these producers would, you know, kill their grandmother for an Oscar, but apparently, you know, money does still top the list for these cats.
Yeah, I was also a part of the, oh, I figured, you know, what we witnessed with the kind of like, you know, writer strike ending, I thought this was going to lead to this kind of being kind of an open and shut, but I think they wanted to try and have one last hurrah. But also, like you said, yeah, just for the outside the industry, but I feel like anyone who works in any kind of like more free, you know, desk job knows that like from Thanksgiving on, it don't talk to me till January, you know, like you get all the meat. I remember the days of trying to like rush a pitch or like a conversation before like halfway through November, because then it's like, we'll circle back in January. So I think, yeah, I think this is exactly what you're kind of saying, Andrea, where it's like everyone, I think everyone on all sides would love deals to be made before the new year. And now they have to come in, pie the piper or whatever the saying is.
Pay the piper?
That too.
But you can pay him in pie, though.
He accepts culinary currency, that piper. Everybody knows that. All right. Speaking of currency. Yes.
Oh, nailed it.
Yes. Gerard Butler settles lawsuit over missing Olympus has fallen profits. This idiot dick comes via my friend Davey Mayer sending us the hot tips. People, please do reach out as you will, especially if you're my friend Davey Mayer. So back in 2021, the star and co-producer of Olympus Has Fallen sued production company Millennium Films for $10 million. Butler's suit alleged a premeditated scheme to misrepresent the movie's revenue in order to avoid paying him his share of the revenues. Now that suit has been settled out of court. Butler's deal promised him 6% of domestic revenue, 2% of foreign revenue, and 10% of net profits. The movie has grossed $170 million and spawned two sequels. The lawsuit claimed that Millennium has understated box office receipt by tens of millions of dollars. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, I'm still mad that, you know, White House Down didn't become the one that was a hit. And we got a sequel to that. Instead, it was Olympus, which is the crappy one. But that said, you know, pay Gerard Butler what you said you would pay Gerard Butler.
Yes.
You know, movie math is ongoing as a crazy thing. You know, I remember back in the 80s when Art Buchwald sued Paramount because he had like a story credit for Coming to America. And that movie was a huge, huge hit, which per studio accounting had not turned a profit.
My favorite example of that is Ed Solomon trots this out, and I've mentioned this on the show before. He wrote the original Men in Black, which also has had like 18 sequels at this point.
Right.
And every year he gets a thing saying that the studio continues to lose money on Men in Black, and therefore he will not be getting any of his participation points. It's insane. Like, how they handle this, and it's at every level. It's at the major studios and whatever. It's absolute nonsense movie things. And as my friend Davey Mayer, third time's a charm, saying his full name, mentioned, like, if they're trying to pull this on Gerard Butler, is a variety of different letters, like, been an A movie star, B, whatever he is, Gerard Butler, international star. If you're trying to pull that on a person who can still get like nobody cares if Ed Solomon's complaining about his writer residuals, apparently. But if you're keeping an actor producer out of the money truck and then they blow it up, they're going to get a little more headlines. But it's such a constant thing. This absolute like slippery accounting. I mean, $170 million gross. Get out of here.
This is like, yeah, you can be Zendaya and still be like, yeah, I had to learn how to read contracts because otherwise they were just going to screw me over. So you're right. Gerard Butler, like, this is his franchise and they've made sequels and he's one of the last of the global names, you know, like you can open a Gerard Butler picture in a lot of parts of the world still. And they're still trying to nickel and dime him.
I mean, the man went to law school. Think twice.
Did he really?
Yes, he did.
Oh, my. God, he contains multitudes.
He's not just your least memorable phantom.
Zing. Speaking of, I had several choices here, and they've all flown out of my head. The Britney Spears audition tape for The Notebook has surfaced. 2004's Nicholas Sparks adaptation, The Notebook, starring Ryan Gosling and Rachel McAdams, is considered a romance classic by many. But last week, we got a glimpse of what might have been an audition tape of Britney Spears reading for the role that would eventually go to McAdams, surfaced on the Daily Mail. A tearful Britney reads with an unseen Ryan Gosling, who, lest we forget, had been her co-star on the Mickey Mouse Club years earlier.
I prayed for you to die. In the war? Really? Well, not die. I would have felt completely horrible if you would have died, but I kind of didn't want you to be alive anymore because I couldn't bear the thought of you being with somebody else or of us never seeing each other again. So I gotta go, okay?
Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, movie history. Also, the swagger to which, you know, be reading with the person who is going to be the lead of the movie, too. Like, yeah, that was... That's like a layup. We all hope for auditions like that.
This was not a chemistry read. This was just... Because you often, like, they're stars when they're actually filming. They won't do the off-camera reading. And he's like, I will come in for Britney's audition. Yes.
We go way back.
Exactly. To me, what stood out, she has a lovely little performance in this. Auditions, painful. Painful to do, painful to watch. I've been in the small rooms with them when people are like 3 feet away from you and you're like sitting at a table like you're the judges on Flashdance and it's just like so uncomfortable. And I've also watched so many like taped auditions. Like they're just hard. The lighting's hard, the whatever. And to have any sort of authenticity or that comfort, the naturalism that you want to see in a performance, she does a lovely job here. And it would be, I would still love, somebody tweeted somewhere about like give her Lohan Christmas movie, and I feel like Alonzo. There's so many avenues to explore there.
Don't tempt me with a good time.
Yeah.
Can I please mention? I'm sure I have before, but I will also insert this as much as possible. My favorite name drop. You guys, you know I love to name drop. If I've ever been in the same room with someone, anything like that, my favorite name drop is that my friend Andrew Schaff plays the guy that Rachel McAdams goes on a date with in the Ferris wheel at the beginning of The Notebook. And then Ryan Gosling crash bombs their scene. And he watches that with his husband all the time because it's the funniest thing ever. Actually, I don't even know if they do anymore, but they used to and it was amused me forever.
My shameful secret, I have never seen The Notebook.
Girl.
Ooh.
Jenna Rollins. What?
I know. Maybe that's like next time we need to. There's nothing good is opening. That's how we kill a week.
What I hear? Oh my god! I would do the Notebook. Yeah, we'll put that. We'll put that on the Max Fun Drive list. Got it.
There we go.
What I'm hearing from you, Alonzo, is you've never been in a home where a TV's just been playing in the background because that movie is never not on.
Yeah, they,
I don't get
really
any of the Turner networks. Yeah.
Oh man, that's so funny. All right, well, look, I guess on that note, we'll take a quick break, but when we come back, we're talking about Killers of the Flower Moon.
Save time, eat well, and stay on track with your healthy lifestyle with chef-prepared, ready-to-eat meals delivered right to your door with Factor, America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit.
Yes, yes. Like I've said before, I've actually been a Factor subscriber even before they, you know, hooked us up with some meal kits and, you know, allowed us to shout them out. Look, y'all know I'm a meathead. Y'all know I like to eat. But the thing I like the most, not having to do anything else other than throw that thing into an oven or a microwave, press a couple buttons, and then it's ready to go. So, and I'm talking about, you know, they got like cranberry pecan chicken, apple Dijon pork chops, you know, stuff you usually pull out a bunch of pots and pans for, but we ain't got to do all that.
Head to factormeals.com/maxfilm50 and use code maxfilm50 to get 50% off. That's code MAXFILM50 at factormeals.com/maxfilm50 to get 50% off.
A Queer History of Aerospace is a new audio miniseries from the Museum of Flight, premiering October 24th.
Located in Seattle, Washington, the Museum of Flight is the largest private, nonprofit air and space museum in the world. A Queer History of Aerospace explores the ways the LGBTQ+ community has shaped aviation and space exploration, and the ways the industry has impacted the LGBTQ+ community. The ultimate goal is to encourage people who have been left off of museum walls to share their own histories so that together we can start telling the whole story.
We love the whole story. You can listen to museumofflight.org/podcast or search The Flight Deck on your favorite podcatcher. New episode every Tuesday beginning October 24th.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ivy Wadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Alonzo Duralde.
Now, before we get into it, Drea, you had something to say, right?
This is a small thing. We're a little family. We love talking about movies. We also love having really thoughtful and resourceful guests who can speak wisely about the movie or subject we're talking about. We had a really wonderful Indigenous creator and programmer attached to come today and unfortunately had a last minute conflict so couldn't be here, but it's important for you all to know that we do care about that and who is speaking about what, and it wasn't an overlook on our part. It was just, you know, sometimes that's how the universe works.
So I guess without further ado, today's movie was directed by Martin Scorsese and depicts the horrific true story of the Osage murders in the 1920s and was heavily influenced by a nonfiction book by the same name, written by David Gran in 2017. Alonzo, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Killers of the Flower Moon?
Sure. So it is, as you said, it takes place in the 1920s. Leonardo DiCaprio plays a returning soldier from World War I who settles into Oklahoma, where his very powerful uncle, played by Robert De Niro, is a rancher and kind of a big local political figure. Because there has been oil found on the Osage land, the members of the Osage Nation are wealthy and have some sense of power and agency, but they are also being murdered one by one, and no one's really investigating and no one's really doing anything about it. And as this wave of crime continues and there's a slow effort on the part of the U.S. government to investigate it, DiCaprio's character falls in love with an Osage woman, Molly, played by the great Lily Gladstone, for reasons that might have to do with his affection for her, but also might have to do with De Niro's character wanting to have his family get in on the oil shares that are controlled by her family. It does not end well, but it does end fascinatingly. And this really happened. And like so many things in American history that happened to people of color, we don't talk about it enough. And so hopefully this movie will start more of a discussion about it. Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, I think to kick this off, oh man, I have a lot of thoughts, but I think the funniest way to kick this off, only and also kind of alluding to something I think Dre was, you know, hinting at, it wasn't this thought, but it will lead to the thought, is did this movie need to be 3 hours and 25 minutes long?
Thank you. Again, I did know where to pee within those 3 hours and 25 minutes. And yes, I actually... as you guys know, because Alonzo has looked on me just a little less favorably ever since you heard my thoughts on The Irishman last year, which I was not a fan of, and also felt acutely in my bones as every minute of it went by. This one, I was riveted, could continue watching, and part of it is a lot of it actually, and I say this with deep affection and admiration for Martin Scorsese as an artist, like what he does with cinema as a language and the importance that he sees to it culturally and historically, and then how that reflects in the stories he shows, I have a lot of respect for. This movie brought a lot of the things to the forefront were the things that with The Irishman, I'm never going to say it right, and that's fine.
The Irishman.
One of my things with that, like if you are a filmmaker in your 80s and you have this wealth of life experience and you're taking stock and you're thinking of what stories do I want to center and what life lessons, what's the takeaway I want for my audience, either insight to how our country is made, which is certainly part of this one, but also whose stories matter, whose stories should things pivot around, who deserves empathy and insight and perspective. And those things to me were missing in that previous film. Like I wanted more from them. I was like, where are the women in this world? Where are the people who are whose lives are affected by all of the killings? Obviously The Irishman, a total separate scenario, but this film, the single human in this that I had the most insight to was Molly Burkhart, who was played by Lily Gladstone magnificently. I mean, that is an actor who can just stare at someone else and you hear an entire paragraph. And the craft of that alone, but it's also poetry. And that there's so much depth and the detail that adds to small things. So the Osage, as Alonzo was saying with the introduction, the idea of, you know, any enrolled member of Osage Nation had a head right. They had stake and ownership and money out of the sort of what came out of the land that was given to them, which was trash land. This was already land that they were pushed onto kind of definitely unwillingly. That listening to that, and they have to go and then still beg like whoever their white solicitor is and identify themselves as incompetent to get their own money. Like just watching Lily Gladstone say Molly Burkhart incompetent, and then why, you know, just those moments to me as a woman and a person who loves film tied it in. And then I'm also getting that avenue of, we see a lot of films that try and tell historical stories. There is a lot to discuss here about who's telling these stories, right? And you can, this movie is such a complicated combination of things because it is really doing a lot of work to do good by the reality of those and where your sympathies should be. But it's also bringing up a lot of thoughtful questions that people rightfully are saying, like, well, this, there's still someone else who actually identifies as Osage that can approach this. I found it, from my reading, as complicated and rich. I still was really grateful for the steps forward and the sympathy of what I was getting. And it was one of those, in a strange way, I can tie back to our conversation of Oppenheimer, of his omission in Oppenheimer of giving us any of the fallout of that tragedy in Japan. Literally. And being like, do you know what I mean? Like there was something of that in, oh, no, this is a movie where you're getting these white characters and you have to identify with them as you're watching. And then you have to realize they're the bad guys, rather than if you're watching just from the sort of point of people who are being taken advantage of, and then you're like, oh, it's, I don't know. I find it so complex and so much to think about.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree with a lot of that, not about The Irishman, because you're still totally wrong about that. this is an epic in the classic sense. Like, this is Scorsese's, like, giant. This is a friend of the show, Nathan Rabin, and I, you know, without talking about it, have the same reflection. This is his Heaven's Gate, but in a good way. Like, you know, when you see some of these massive scenes where he's clearly, like, built this town and he's got all these extras and all these cars and all of this stuff that's going on, but it's all in the service of this story that he's telling. And it's like, it's the, you know, it's the resources of Heaven's Gate, but applied to a movie that, and with as powerful a story about, like, you know, racism and exploitation as Heaven's Gate, but I think carried off much more successfully. So yeah, I think he needs that running time to give you all of that stuff. And when I was watching it, I mean, Dre, you're right. I think the you know, of course, the right wing idiots were already like, oh, it's woke, because they go in thinking, oh, well, De Niro and DiCaprio are our heroes, right? Because they're the white guys, you know. But I just kept thinking about, like, I didn't know any of this, and I felt like when I was watching Watchmen on HBO, and that's how I learned about the Tulsa riots, which are cited here, and I'm like, good Lord, like, it is appalling, the stuff we don't talk about in this country and don't teach in this country, and, like, we have to wait for some big movie to sneak it in, basically, so that, like, dopes like me will know that it happened.
Yeah, you know, that's the everything that was said, I think, is so true. And to me, it's I would love to jump back into this. I want to say a different time, but the reason I say this is why I laugh at the idea of jumping back into this at a different time. I think right now, and why we're up against so much discourse, is it is hard to sit in the first third of the movie kind of as Leonardo DiCaprio, and you're kind of like, it's hard to watch, it's real, it's true, it's hard to watch, but it's hard to watch in everything that's been happening lately. I think it's really hard to watch, and it's like this kind of like weird seesaw, right, where it's like you want to show how bad this was and how, because you really see how ingrained and calculated this takeover was. And, you know, I had to look it up, you know, to really get the ins and outs. And you see that, like, you know, Washington, D.C. had to make a law that was like, if you aren't from of like the blood, you can't just kind of jump in and take the inheritance, because this was what we saw, a perceived just like takeover. And I do love the nod to the Tulsa riots. There is, like, just a point where I'm like, oh, I'm seeing so much pain. You know, I'm seeing so much pain. Yeah. When are we going to hit the point of why we come to see movies, which I think is the moment we see our good boy, Jesse Plemons. When you see Jesse Plemons show up, you're either really excited or terrified. That is his role as an actor now. And I almost audibly cheered when you saw him knock on that door. And it was like, and that's when the movie truly ramped up for me, because, like, you know, I've mentioned this as much, and you can taste it in all of my reviews of all of our more recent, like, queer films and stuff, is I've reached the point where I'm like, I want to see the oppressors getting their ass kicked. Yeah. I want to see it. I, however, understand where Marty's coming from in this, because we're friends now, because I spent 3 hours and 20 minutes with him, so we're friends. If I can pick him up at the LAX airport now, because I can feel in this that he really wants to showcase, like, how fucked up this is. Like, you can feel in everything he's showing, it wasn't for the sake of, like, just showing it. It was like, I need you to understand just how fucked up this act was, and just the kind of, like, just like the cuts into the different deaths, like when you're first kind of introduced to it, and then you kind of see the more long play deaths, and you just see how gross it was. And then
the doctors are in on it.
Doctors, like, yeah. Everyone white is in on it. And then there was a point where I was like, damn, Marty captured the scene where she, after I believe it was her sister's death, and she's walking through the crowd of white people, and it shows them looking at her, and you're sitting with her grief and having to look at this place that was once filled with Native people. Once, you know, as someone who was here when Echo Park and Highland Park was like 90 to 100% Latino, and, you know, not to make this like heavily political, but all art is, so fuck you if you're mad about it. But like, you know, to see like, you know, Martin Scorsese, you know, totally capture this is kind of what I think is the important part of this argument. You know, of like showcasing, like, what are you trying to do? Is he trying to like snatch the story and tell it a la Green Book? Or is he really trying to like showcase this story? He had the consultant. I think the biggest outcry is that, you know, she should have been the main character, Molly, which, you know, I agree, but I think with what he's done, Marty knows he knows white men. And so he did white men.
And I would add to that, because I agree. To me, she is the main character in that, mm-hmm. she is the person I am rooting for and care about. And I also think...
And she's the one who has an arc.
Has a full arc. Uh-huh. She has all that. I won't lie, I'm with you. There was definitely a moment, like, when she's getting sicker and sicker that I really was like, oh, I know it's not going to happen because I've seen Scorsese films, but I would very much like this to turn into Django Unchained, and I would like that woman to fucking wreak some vengeance like nobody's business. So I am available to watch that movie when it gets made. But for me, the complications of introducing America's sweethearts, Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro, and showing them, and I find their brand of evil so yes. much more believable yes. and so much more complex. And I think that yes. even in real life, like, if you look at it, was something that came up like with Columbine, like that idea, if you just classify that people who do bad, horrific and unexplainable acts as just evil, it lets mm-hmm. them off the hook. And the yeah. reality is, like you said, this stuff was systemic. There was a whole platform of people working together to take advantage of another people that involved murder, that involved fraud, like that involved all of these terrible acts. And so if you're showing these guys, and to me, like, this is De Niro's best villain in the sense of that that weaselly smile on his face, him speaking Osage, like,
oh, yeah.
how, like, the ingratiating himself, all of those things, that is so much more horrific to me than just if he'd been like mustache twirling. And no, that they even give, like, the fact that they do those shots with him in his driving goggles to kind of like take a little of the fear factor. Do you know what I mean?
He is the human equivalent of a smallpox-infected blanket in this movie.
Yes. You know? Yes.
He appears like something that's going to be useful and friendly, and oh, God, no.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's truly just wild to see how ingrained it was, and just the old-timer being like, I saw everything. I'll tell you. They didn't want me to tell you, but now you're here. And it just watching them crumble, and it just really made it just so sweet. And now we're gonna, I think I want to talk about this, because my thoughts on this, because you talked about this being you know, his like Heaven's Gate complimentary, and I think, like, the moment when we get to you know, light spoilers ahead,
We have to talk about the ending.
The radio play scene. This really felt like Martin Scorsese taking a bow. Like, I was like, I wouldn't be surprised if he's like, this is it. You know, I think there's nothing in this earth that will stop him from making movies.
I'm going to go out with this, and more his decision at this ending. To me, it 100% worked for me. I mean, I think it works for you. It does not. It 100% works for me, because you get this ending that completely illustrates the disregard for a story like this and its impact, its the sorrow associated with it, the deep damage that it's done by making it like a trivial, a true flippant, crime. Like, yes, a funny true crime radio play and like, ooh, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, like you have your Foley moments and like fun actors. Like there's this thing of how it trivializes the 3 hours you spent before there watching and how that 3 hours still only represents years and years of time. And so that, and then the final dismount, two-punch dismount of Scorsese himself, I wept. When he started reading Molly Burke, I was like, oh, I'm a mess. And then we go into this aerial of present-day members of the Osage. I was like, oh, thank you. I feel like I have a lot of questions for you, Mr. Filmmaker, and I feel like you're trying to tell me in this moment what you were trying to do.
Yeah, to me it felt like he was acknowledging, I am ultimately not the person who should be telling you this story, or you are, or at least I'm the person who's telling you this story through my filter, no matter how much effort I have made to try and have consultants and get this story right and you know, be true to the facts. And so it's almost like the movie is acknowledging you are watching this story from several removes and told mostly by white people, you know, writing the film, directing the film, you know, editing the film, all of that stuff. And so understand that the version that you are taking in is a piece of art, but is not necessarily, you know, a piece of lived fact the way that it is for the people that that went through all this.
I'll add, and because I would love to turn into the performances, because there are, I'm going to say approximately 383 actors in this film, and the amount of performers they have, like Barry Corbin's in there for like a single line. Like,
yes!
Like every single random person in the background of anything is either...
The lying lady from True Stories is in one scene.
I mean, get out of here. Like all of those, but then they also found... There's this guy with a scar on his face. I was like, how did they find this time traveler who's clearly been living in a mine in Appalachia? How did they just roll him out of the 1920s? But on top, I'll just segue off of that to get into the performances. I'll also add, in addition to the many, many consultants he had, both with like Osage language, with history, with culture, the casting, the indigenous performers in this, that there's people like there, like God, I can't remember his first name, but Redcorn, who plays the chief of this, like, is literally a descendant of Redcorn, who was a chief. Like, there's so much thought going on to like who's saying what, so that there's this element of truth in the scenes when you're with the sort of with the tribal council and everything, that you're like, the things that they are yelling about in this scene are transcendent. They are talking in character of this moment in time, but I feel that pain reverberate and having those people feeling trusted and safe in that space. Like, that's part of what you're doing as a filmmaker.
Yeah. You said it perfectly. Yeah. The performances. And I think also some of the, you know, deep cuts, you know, that, and not like deep cut, like, oh man, but like, you know, like people were like, oh yeah, where has John Lithgow been? What's up? And also, I know exactly when Brendan Fraser was filming this. You know, like things like that. You're like,
poor Brendan Fraser. Fraser.
Oh, he was Fraser. He killed it. I
thought he was great. Oh, There's been a whole lot of talk about him. I'm like, I'm sorry. You don't roll in the guy to be the absolute smarmy oil salesman. The lawyer, and then not have it. He's literally supposed to be showboating. That's what he's supposed to be doing. And you're going to like call him out on a line reading when his like description is like showboating in the courtroom.
Yeah, the character is hamming it up. Well, what else can the actor do, you know?
Also, it was very clear.
The casting of jowls in this movie. We could do a whole Hall of Excellence. You've never seen so many jowls in your life. And everyone has Leo on down. Every man has that turtle downward turned mouth for at least one frame of them making downward turn mouth. Yes, thank you, Iffy. Oh, why aren't you in this? Were you in this? Are you a lawyer?
No, yeah. I was practicing though. I was like, Marty, when you need me.
Next one.
When you need me, when you're ready.
Yeah.
To put some black people.
And you know, Scott Shepard as just like your classic like chinless wonder, you know. He's a striking guy. I've seen like pictures of him in real life, but in this movie they have turned him into like that non-entity white guy.
He's the brother, right?
Yeah. Just along for the ride.
Yeah.
But yeah, Lily Gladstone, I mean, just, ever since seeing her in Certain Women, the Kelly Reichardt movie, I just, she's always been, I think just such a, so one of my favorite actresses working right now. I mean, her role on Reservation Dogs was so great. Brief appearance in First Cow, but like just, again, like you said, looks at somebody and you've got a monologue.
I'll also shout out to Tantu Cardinal, who played her mother in this. I think she's extraordinary. She's legend. In this, oh God, she's in that, it's like a French Canadian adaptation of, Louise Penny novels. And she's so good. The Three Pines, just Three Pines. She's in those and she's just so good. She's been in a million things, but,
yeah,
I'm down to vote.
Yeah,
here vote, to vote, vote, ready to vote.
Vote. All right. So, you know, the way that we vote for things on this pod, screen it being the highest, stream it being the next highest, and skip it being self-explanatory. So who wants to start?
I'm a screen it. I just almost said stream it. I'm like, ooh, effusive. Skip it. I found this. Oh, this was just incredible. This was like, this is watching a movie, right? It's a capital M movie because it's doing so much. It's immersive. It's clicking along. Structurally, it's fascinating. It's kind of moving back forward in time and really, like, in slight ways, not in things that you're noticing, but all of a sudden you're like, oh, they have two children. Oh, okay, that's happened. Like, it's doing a lot. As an adaptation, it's really interesting. I did read this book. And to nod to what Iffy said, in terms of an adaptation, and I know this is a story that got retooled a lot during the pandemic when it kind of had to shut down, and they did really recenter everything. And it makes sense because the thrust of this book is around Jesse Plemons, like, band of, and it is this sort of multicultural band of guys. And I'm like, yeah, I really don't want to see the origins of the FBI. Please don't make me cheer for the FBI.
Yeah,
like,
thank you.
Please don't make me get psyched about what Hoover's up to. Thank
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
Look. I do want to thank you for having
friend
name?
Of the downtrodden everywhere.
Yeah. But they either way, like having that as the middle of it, no thank you. Having them come when they did, great. And so liked the shape of it, loved the story of it, absolutely had my heart broken. And like Alonzo said, it really opened a lot of doors of like, oh my God, I need to know so much more about this country. And if anyone ever is asking you, like, what are they talking about? America's built on, like, lies,
white
slavery,
supremacy.
And theft, and white supremacy. Yeah, do you want to know what white supremacy looks like? This is what it looks like. But it's also a great watch. Don't let me share. Yeah. And most importantly. Yeah.
Not without its laughs, honest. No, I'm totally a screen it, and I think it's an important distinction to make because this will be popping up on Apple TV Plus in the next month or so. But if you're thinking, I'll just wait, really, if you feel comfortable going into theaters, go to the theater to see this one. We have not even mentioned the holy triumphant of Rodrigo Prieto, who shot this, this and Barbie in the same year.
Yeah.
The legendary Thelma Schoonmaker, who is always Marty's go-to editor, and the great Jack Fisk, who is the production designer here. Like, this is a movie that is tactile, and it is sweeping, and it is tragic, and all the things that you want from your big screen, overwhelming cathedral in the dark experience of going to the movies. So yes, scream it.
And I throw out Robbie Robertson in terms
of
that.
Yes, the late
as
Robbie
well.
Robertson's great score too.
Just, yeah, passed away this summer, did the score, and I believe has indigenous roots himself.
He does.
Yeah. Iffy.
You
bring
know
it home.
It's going to be, yeah. Yeah, this is going to be a screen it for me. Yeah, like in a perfect, I really love that sequence at the top of the movie where right before this town, you see that where they came from before. In my head, I want to see more pre, little less suffering, more get back, Marty at the end bringing it home. But those are very nitpicky and just like little like, you know, but this is, yeah, a beautiful epic, like Alonzo said, and is very, 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 very important. I think there is so much history in this. And I think, you know, along with watching this, listen to the folks, the native people who are speaking on this and hearing their thoughts. And, you know, just always, you know, with any piece of media, just stay fully informed on all sides of it.
And if there's an indigenous filmmaker that wants to make a Django Unchained on this exact subject, hit me up.
Yeah, Dre is ready to produce.
We'll produce.
Yeah. And while we check our emails, we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
People say not to judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree.
Which is why here on Just the Zoo of Us, we judge them by so much more.
We rate animals out of 10 in the categories of effectiveness, ingenuity, and aesthetics, taking into consideration each animal's true strengths, like a pigeon's ability to tell a Monet from a Picasso, or a polar bear's ability to play basketball.
Guest experts like biologists, ecologists, and more join us to share their unique insight into the animal's world.
Listen with friends and family of all ages on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts.
It's the final week of Co-Optober. I'm Kira Gowan, Ad Operations Specialist, and I'm here with...
Daniel Barwella, Technology and Data Specialist. To cap off National Co-op Month, we're sharing how worker-owned co-ops can benefit their communities. Read about it in our newsletter or on social media at MaxFunHQ.
We're also trying to do our part. We're volunteering at our local food bank this week, and we encourage you to volunteer in your area too.
On Friday, we're announcing the donation that you helped raise in the post-MaxFundrive sticker sale, going to 5 food banks across the U.S.
And we want to make sure you know that this is your last chance to get our limited edition Co-op Launch Crew merch.
Grab a pin, hat, shirt, or hoodie before they disappear at the end of the month.
Details on merch, resources for volunteering, and all things Co-Optober can be found at MaximumFun.org/Co-Optober.
That's Cooptober. Thank you so much for your support and have a great Co-Optober.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiwe. In the studio with me are...
Alonzo Duraldi.
Drea Clark.
And Marissa Flaxbart. I am here just for a quick follow-up to Hall of Excellence. The topic, of course, of last week's Hall of Excellence was best testimony under oath in a movie. You know, we could have let this one ride one more week, but it was kind of looking like, what's the point? Because just really running away with it. Is My Cousin Vinny.
Oh, yay!
Yeah.
Nice.
You know, in a way, this is a victory for Ify and Alonzo.
Yeah.
I'm certainly claiming it, yes.
Who really handed this one to Ify on a silver platter. We got some comments from listeners. Kevin says that their pick would be Lady Chablis' testimony in Midnight of in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Good one. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
And Ray says, love to see Marissa Tomei absolutely bodying the competition. So.
You know what I can't believe we forgot to mention is I like to think of it as an assist in the beauty of that performance is its mention in Fire Island in the reenactment.
That's
my
true.
My biological clock is tick, tick. That's not it's not the testimony per se, but the sort of cultural reminder of the relevance Indeed. And significance of that performance.
It lives on.
Yeah.
One last thing, and then I'll let you get to the rest of this C section. Kate said that I don't think a lot of people have seen Witness for the Prosecution. I haven't listened to the episode yet. Is that Alonzo's pick?
Yes.
Amazing.
But she also adds that she read it was Christie's favorite adaptation of her work. So
funny. That makes sense.
Oh, okay, cool.
Wow.
Yes, leaves me to pick the 75-year-old black and white movie.
Yeah, look.
It's worth a watch,
everybody. It's my job here.
All right, on with the show. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, Marissa.
Thank you. Yeah, always good to have you. So today's movie had a lot of new faces in it, new to the audience and new to Martin Scorsese films. That said, Robert De Niro has been in 10 Scorsese films, dating back to 1973's Mean Streets. Leonardo DiCaprio has been in 6 Scorsese films, starring in 2002's with Gangs of New York. What are some of your favorite director-actor partnerships, and what are some long-term working relationships would you love to see?
Well, the Blu-ray of Showing Up comes out this week.
Yeah, that was mine, yeah.
Which immediately reminded me of the Michelle Williams-Kelly Reichardt duopoly. They've worked together in films like Wendy and Lucy and Meek's Cutoff. And I think they're really dynamite. I had Certain Women, which also features Lily Gladstone. I'm a big fan of their work individually, but I think together they really like hit a vibe. And I'm sure at this point, all of their actor-director communications are in like, you know, some sort of twin shorthand that only they understand. But I absolutely am always thrilled when I hear those two are going to be working together again.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know I'm new to the clan, but, you know, we also got a shout out, you know, good old Wes Anderson, Jason Schwartzman. You know, you can't have the Wes without the Schwartz. Love that face, too. It's a good face.
I mean, that's several, like Wes Anderson has that with, you could say that about Bill Murray.
That's true.
You could say that about
Ralph
Fiennes, Tilda Swinton.
Yeah. I think Jason, because he's done the most with?
Probably, because he's going all the way back to Rushmore. So
Murray was in Rushmore. I have no idea what the count is, but I fully agree. Because I also think, like, Bill Murray was a star before then, and Wes Anderson has been there, like, for the duration of Jason
Schwartzman's career. Yeah, true.
But I mean, Wes Anderson working with a troupe, I always love. This is more for the second part of it, but I often think of actors that I would like to see integrated into the Wes Anderson troupe. Hong Chow is one of my favorite actors ever.
Yeah.
And I feel like she could be,
definitely, you know,
consumed into the, like, that blend of straight-faced comedy. Like, I think...
Well, if Asteroid City is any indication, yes, more, please.
Right, yeah. Exactly. An existing pairing that I love, Sofia Coppola and Kirsten Dunst. Mm-hmm. I think that Sofia Coppola has always seen parts of Kirsten Dunst as an actor. Like, if it's Shades or Distinctions that are interesting and unique and brings them out, and they're also always a little different. I very like the pairing of them and how they work together. And then another one, that a team that we love and have talked about, Bong Joon-ho and Sang Kang-ho from Parasite. They're in like a lot of director Bong's films, but like as an actor, Sang Kang-ho, and I'm definitely saying his name wrong. I can't wait for Ingu to tell me how I'm saying it wrong. But, like, he's someone who has these, like, paternal sides, criminal sides. He's an authority figure. Anyway, I think that Director Bong works with him in really fluid, interesting ways. Yeah, I love that.
I think in terms of existing ones, again, like Todd Haynes and Julianne Moore, certainly. I haven't seen May December yet, which I'm very pumped about, and that's opening before the end of the year and
it's
coming
great.
To Netflix, so I'm sure we'll be talking about it here. You know, and Almodovar's, you know, company, you know, Antonio Banderas, Penelope Cruz, Carmen Maura, now Tilda Swinton, you know, is in the loop there. And, you know, I think about, like, really... any of my favorite actresses, I just want to see them work with Almodovar at some point because he's, you know, so friggin' great. And not just a women's director, but as a women's director, I think is one of our best. Dave White will not forgive me if I don't mention the long-term partnership between Chai Ming Lang and Lee Keng Shang, the Taiwanese filmmaker, and his recurring star who basically is in all of his movies as kind of a version of Chai Ming Lang. They have sort of a, you know, back in the day, Francois Truffaut cast... Jean-Pierre Léaud in The 400 Blows, which is his first movie, and then followed that character from childhood into adulthood, always casting the same actor as the character Antoine Doinel. And so Chai Ming Lang has the same deal going with Lee Keng Shang that Truffaut and Léaud once had.
Yeah. In my head, I want to say, you know, give that shout out to, you know, Michael B. and Coogler.
Yep.
That's sure. One. Yes.
Yeah. Let's see, you know, Apatow, and Rogan and mm-hmm. and the gang, you know, the Freaks and Geekers, freaking Geekers.
I mean, like Del Toro, does he, I mean, apart from Doug Jones, Doug obviously, Jones? Exactly. For sure.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
And then some of them you wish, like if David Fincher found a muse, wouldn't that be great?
Mm. Oh yeah.
Who could handle that? Who could handle that? Yeah, I do. I was thinking Marissa suggested Greta Gerwig and Saoirse Ronan. I like, honestly, Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie, I will watch a ton of things. Yeah. I feel like, especially with the producing power of Margot Robbie, there are a lot of different genres those two could take on.
Gerwig and Chalamet, let's not forget.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Little shells, yeah. Baby shells. Little
Timmy T.
How dare we? How dare we leave him to last, but not a bad place to end.
Yeah. Well, speaking of endings, it's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Oh, no.
It's not.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no, it's not.
Sorry. I'm looking at, look, here's the thing. As I forgot that it is officially the beginning of the big year. The Christmas Zaddy has awoken out of the cryo sleep, wearing the red coat, black boots, pointy but floppy red hat. It is time.
I don't care that Halloween hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Look, it starts when it starts, and no other holidays can get in the way. It's time for the Christmas Zaddy's Own Christmas Movie Minute. Alonzo, we hear that your holiday movie intake has begun, so are you ready to give us the first Christmas Movie Minute of 2023?
I was born ready.
I was going to say, I think it's more, are we ready? And I'm right here on the edge of my seat.
Okay, so Hallmark Channel kicks off Friday with Checkin' It Twice, which is a hockey movie that was mostly ridiculous, but, you know, Kevin McGarry, after an entire season of When Calls the Heart, I'm sure, was happy to tell some jokes. He has a very funny eggnog drinking sequence. It's worth seeing it just for that. Where Are You Christmas? Bold, big strike, big swing for the fences for Hallmark. A woman wishes Christmas didn't exist, and the world becomes black and white, and people turn back into color when they remember Christmas. So it's like Pleasantville and a little bit of Pottersville. Doesn't entirely stick the landing, but Michael Rady's always really charming, and Lindsay Fonseca is good. Worth checking out because they're really trying something here. Under the Christmas Sky, this is what dumb Hallmark looks like, especially when you cast Ryan Pavey as an astrophysicist. But didn't really super do it for me, I gotta say. And then, oh my God, The Christmas Venue. Please be the worst Christmas movie I see this year, because I can't imagine anything dumber than a plot where two people have to pretend to be married because the wife of a mother potential client doesn't trust single people.
Nice!
Yeah, that was, yep, that was great. And that's just that snippet alone makes me realize how silly that is, but almost.
I was
almost
worried.
Makes me want to see it.
Yeah, I was worried when you started by trashing a hockey movie that I wasn't going to be with you, and then you really stuck the landing yourself, so.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. What I'm here for.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. After that rousing Christmas movie minute, I think it's time for staff picks. It can be any movie at all. Who would like to start?
I am late on this and I'm embarrassed, but it is an actual perfect Halloween watch, so I'm not entirely like submerged in Christmas just yet. Werewolves Within. Josh Rubin's very funny horror comedy, locked room mystery, paranoid thriller, all the things, you know, about a small town in Colorado with a new park ranger and a new mail carrier and sudden weird bloody disappearances of people, leading people to think that, oh my gosh, there's a werewolf on the loose. Or is it just that everybody in town is awful? It could go either way for most of the running time, and that's part of what makes the movie so exciting, but also very funny. Sam Richardson, always hilarious. He and Milena Vayntrub have really great chemistry. An entire cast of brilliant comedy heavy hitters, the likes of Michael Chernus and Harvey Guillen, Cheyenne Jackson, Michaela Watkins. It is currently streaming on Hulu and Canopy, And it is a lot of fun. Don't sleep on Werewolves Within like I did. I should have been on this earlier.
I'll back that up. That's a great
yeah,
one.
Yeah. Friend of the pod, Josh Rubin, directed that.
Yes.
So we'll have to, you know, I'll drag him on here someday. He's shooting a thing, but good, funny ass man, even funnier director. But yeah, big shout out. Drea, didn't mean to cut you off.
No, no, not at all. I was just concurring. I like that choice. In fact, I think a year ago, it might have been a staff pick of mine.
Quite possibly. Which is,
I am down to make it an annual occurrence because I had the same reaction. I was like, oh, I am pleasantly surprised by this motion picture. And when does that happen? My staff pick is more tied into the film we discussed today. It is a film by a First Nations director Jeff Barnaby, who sadly passed away last year. It's he's called Rhymes for Young Ghouls, G-H-O-U-L-S, not girls. And it stars Devery Jacobs, that many people would recognize from Reservation Dogs. The POV is of the lead, who's a teenage girl, and it's set in the kind of the Canadian residential school system and digs into the history of abuse by agents of the government. And it is really dynamic filmmaking and a very exciting and yet cut short too quickly career as a filmmaker. But Jeff Barnaby has a couple of films out there. You can check out Rhymes for Young Ghouls on a variety of Alonzo approved platforms. It's on Tubi. It's on Hoopla. It's on Canopy.
Yeah, it is.
Fandor. You can also rent it. It's like a couple dollars in a number of places. I highly recommend checking it out, especially if you are looking for stories, indigenous stories told by indigenous people. That's a great way to start if it's new to you. And I do want to nod, this is less of a staff pick to view and more of a listen to, and I feel like was maybe a What's Good of Mine last year, but so directly ties into a lot of the discussion points for Killers of the Flower Moon. There's a This American Life episode called Little War on the Prairie, close to my heart because it is about a resident from Mankato, Minnesota, who goes back to explore why he was never taught anything about the bloodshed at the center of town that was really at the formation of Mankato and a lot of Minnesota. We do not learn, taught about. It's very like, oh, none of that happened here. All good. All good. Carry on. It's a great listen. So I highly recommend it. Little War on the Prairie.
Nice. And with me, you know, I'm just going to say there will be blood just because I was getting vibes. And maybe it's just time period, but that's the vibes I'm like that I was just feeling. And I was like, yes. So keeping it nice and simple. There will be blood.
On Paramount Plus.
Thank you, Alonzo. All right. Well, thank you once again, Dre and Alonzo, for another wonderful show. Always great to have you, have these discussions with you. And you, listener, thank you for listening. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels that are all linked in the show notes. Next week, we'll be talking about the Persian version. Our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is also wonderful. Her name is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun.
A worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.